Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
An economic slump is really more of an endurance test, if you think about it. It'll end eventually, provided that even when consumers get real tired of being squeezed, they keep on consuming. And tired they are. The government's retail sales report came out today, down for the first time in 5 months. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 13th of August. Great to have you here, as always. And listen, not to pry, but what are you doing with yourself this summer? I ask because it's pretty clear not too many of us are spending a lot of time shopping. The Department of Commerce reported July retail sales this morning, down 0.1%. In and of itself, not a big number, especially considering high gas prices and worries about the economy. Oh, and the fact that we're just not interested in one specific item. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth explains.
Americans just aren't buying vehicles these days, especially big ones.
The most profitable vehicles, the big SUVs and the big pickup trucks, are selling very poorly. They're down something like 20-25%, in some cases 30% from July a year ago.
David Healy follows the auto industry for Burnham Securities. He says people are buying some vehicles.
Some of the smaller vehicles that get better mileage, particularly small passenger cars, are selling very strongly.
But overall, car and truck sales are down. And because SUVs cost a lot more than those little fuel-efficient deals, the total take is a lot less. Joel Naroff is chief economist at Commerce Bank. He says vehicle sales, or the lack thereof, really pulled on today's numbers.
And as a result of that, consumer spending is soft, but it's not terrible, and that's what seemed to come out of July's retail sales numbers.
People bought more furniture, housewares, and electronics in July, which more than anything points up the volatility of these monthly numbers. All those sectors were down in June. The price of goods we imported also went up in July, but just as lousy car sales pulled down retail sales, high oil prices pushed import prices up. Get ready for more worrying inflation news. The government releases the Consumer Price Index tomorrow and the Producer Price Index next week. Naroff expects those numbers to be disappointing, too. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Detroit's doing everything it can to turn around those lousy sales figures Elisa was telling us about. Chrysler announced today it's spending almost $2 billion to reconfigure an assembly plant to make smaller and one figures more fuel-efficient SUVs. GM said it's expanding its manufacturing in Asia to tap into an expanding market there. But do what they might, they're still stuck trying to serve American consumers as well, consumers that are seeing gas prices fall for the first time in a very long while. That might well be temporary, but it makes Detroit's balancing act between big cars and fuel efficiency trickier than ever. Jessica Caldwell's an analyst at Edmunds.com. Jessica, good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
So let me ask you something. You ready?
Yes.
Channel Rick Wagner, the CEO of General Motors, for me for a second, or Bob Nardelli, the guy who's running Chrysler. What are they thinking as they see gas prices falling a little bit and they are well aware of American consumers' desire for the biggest car they can possibly get?
I think everyone saw this coming. I don't think anyone saw it as fast. They definitely both realize that they don't really have the product lineup that suits the United States tastes and needs perfectly. And I think a lot of adjustments have to be made, and they have to be made fast. They can't have a 5-10-year plan. They need a short-term plan. And really, they need to work on the communications of saying, hey, we have these vehicles coming out. They'll be fuel efficient. They'll be smaller. And they'll be good quality.
Problem is, though, I mean, they have started doing their product line shifts. They're laying off people and they're starting to make smaller cars. But those changes take years and millions of dollars.
They do. It's not going to be something that's going to happen overnight for sure. But they have made some interesting steps. Ford, for instance, has made public knowledge that they plan to bring the Ford Fiesta and the Ford Focus. Both are very popular small cars in Europe. So that takes a little bit of a shorter time period since they already have the models. They have to make them fit and regulated for the U.S. market. But it's a little bit faster than developing them from scratch.
Can you help us understand what history tells us? I mean, we had in the 1970s, we had the oil embargo days and oil shooting up to lo and behold, a dollar or more a gallon. What did Detroit do then?
You know, it's kind of a different mindset, but I think a lot of people, you know, have referenced that of, you know, we've been through this before. We, you know, is it going to be the same thing? Is it going to be different? And we saw what happened before. We saw, you know, an interest in small cars. But then eventually the years went on and we, you know, we discovered this great thing called the SUV and everyone had to have one. But, you know, now I think the shift has definitely, you know, been different. Now we're not seeing this, you know, going down. We're seeing this stabilizing, staying the same, and we really just have to have no choice but to adapt to it.
Is the calculus here tougher to figure out for the big car makers than it was back in the 70s?
I think so. If you look at the number of models out on the road, the number of different types of vehicles they're out, it's not such a clear-cut picture. I mean, we have hybrid large SUVs, hybrid small SUVs. There's so many different varieties and flavors now that we didn't have back then, and many more players. So it's all a much more complex, you know, equation than it ever has been. And it's going to keep going in that direction as different technologies are developed and different things are spun off. And it's going to be more complicated.
Jessica Caldwell is an auto industry analyst at Edmunds.com. Jessica, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
There is one bright spot on GM's horizon, not an official one, but I imagine at this point the company will take just about anything it can get. A neurologist in New York, a physician, has been keeping track of the number of people who've signed up to buy GM's new electric car, the Chevy Volt. 33,000 people are on the waiting list for that car. It's scheduled to hit the market in 2010. The Transportation Department told us today Americans are driving less. Not a big surprise given what's been going on at the gas station, but the decline has been impressive. Since November, we've cut 53 billion miles from our driving habits over the same period a year ago. Just for context here, the biggest drop during the oil embargoes and gas lines of the 1970s that I was just asking Ms. Caldwell about was a mere 49 billion miles. Meanwhile, the slide in oil prices came to an end today. Lower than expected U.S. inventories and concerns about the fighting between Georgia and Russia did the trick. Crude closed up $3, the first real rise in a week. Here at home, angst over gas prices has prompted a number of congressional proposals to do something, to do anything, because this is an election year after all. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports now on one compromise that is getting some traction.
A bipartisan group of moderate senators, calling themselves the Gang of Ten, is backing a proposal that takes a little bit from both sides in the debate over oil prices. Their idea is to allow southeastern states to approve drilling offshore for more oil. The proposal would also raise as much as $30 billion for conservation and energy efficiency programs by repealing a number of tax credits for oil companies. Drilling opponents say it'll take 10 years to bring new domestic oil to market, but Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute sees a quick psychological impact on oil prices.
Knowing that a new source of petroleum in a stable country is coming online will have an immediate effect.
Polls show most Americans favor more offshore drilling, prompting even hardcore opponents like Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to allow a vote on the idea, as she told CNN's Larry King this week.
Well, we can do that. We can have a vote on that, but it has to be part of something that says we want to bring immediate relief to the public and not just a hoax on them.
Pelosi says conservation and switching to alternative fuels will have a quicker impact on gas prices. But Sarah Banaszak with the American Petroleum Institute says hitting up oil companies to pay for the transition would be counterproductive.
Taxes on the industry are raising the cost of delivering the product to the consumer.
The Gang of Ten senators acknowledge their proposal faces some daunting odds in Congress this fall, but say without their compromise, nothing will get past the Senate before next year. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more worries about the credit crunch and retail sales fatigue took some of the joy out of things. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Media companies are increasingly taking a page out of the political playbook, the page that says all politics is local. Papers and websites are banking on the same being true for all kinds of news. Tomorrow, the online Huffington Post, which bills itself as the internet newspaper, spins off its first local franchise in Chicago. Marketplace's Renita Jablonski has that story.
Browsing the Huffington Post around lunchtime today, the site's full of stories about the conflict between Georgia and Russia. Tomorrow, that same space on the Huffington Post Chicago may be dedicated to Illinois lawmakers fighting over budget issues, or hip-hop star Kanye West opening a Fatburger franchise in a Chicago suburb.
It's an attempt to try to do what a lot of people are saying websites ought to be doing now, publishers ought to be doing, which is to try to go hyper-local.
Joseph Thoreau is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication. The local take on the Post is modeled after the national version. It'll link to articles from newspapers like the Chicago Tribune and area blogs like the Chicagoist. Thoreau says while the Post could increase traffic for those sites, it may also compete with them.
From the standpoint of Chicago online publishers and the print media there that are struggling like many in the country, it could be a problem.
Willow Bay is senior editor at the Huffington Post. She says the goal is to work with Chicago sites, not against them. But she admits growing the Huffington Post brand will mean bringing in a steady stream of advertisers.
I think there's significant ad revenue potential, but I'm not going to comment on ads already in.
Bay says HuffPo, as some regular readers call it, could be rolled out in 10 to 20 more local markets during the next year and a half. I'm Renita Jablonski for Marketplace.
State and federal regulators are close to forcing a thaw in one part of the credit market that's been frozen for months now. CNBC and Reuters are reporting that as many as six big Wall Street banks would be part of the deal on auction rate securities. The auction rate market, as we've been telling you, has been stuck since this spring. That's left investors big and small settled with bonds they can't unload. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
Auction rate securities were pitched as a safe short-term investment that pays a higher interest rate than U.S. Treasuries. But the banks are accused of misleading investors that they could get their money quickly when they needed it. Regulators have already reached buyback settlements with Citigroup and UBS. They've agreed to pay a combined total of $250 million in fines and buy back roughly $27 billion of the debt from their customers. James Cox is a securities law professor at Duke University. He says rival investment banks haven't just been getting pressure from regulators. He's heard their own sales departments have been screaming.
The brokers obviously have a dog in this fight. Their dog is not so much the fact that they have any legal exposure, but the fact that they have this product has created a lot of bad will among their customers, and the brokers, of course, would like to get those customers back and trading with them.
Cox says a global settlement will assure the banks that they'll all be treated equally in putting this mess behind them. And securities law attorney Jake Szymanski says the customers should be treated equally, too.
I've heard from investors all over the country who have accounts at many different banks, all saying the same thing. They were lied to about liquidity. The firms put their own interest ahead of the customers. So it's important to have a global settlement because the problems weren't confined to just a couple of firms. It was across the board.
The settlement could also end up affecting the hit other investors will take, since big corporations and pension funds also had money in these securities. Their bottom lines stand to suffer. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve said the other day that banks have tightened up their lending standards. That would explain why the Fed still feels like it needs to help out in easing the credit crunch. It pumped another $25 billion into the banking system this week. A move like that has a lot of implications. Some good, some not so good, depending on whom you talk to. Commentator Robert Reich says however you feel about what the Fed does, you ought to have more of a say in it.
Chinese authoritarian capitalism, on display this week in Beijing, has me thinking about America's democratic capitalism and how we practice it. Start with the economy's most powerful government agency, the Fed, of course. Its decisions on short-term interest rates will either prolong this recession or pull us out of it. But the Fed is not directly accountable to American voters, or even to Congress or the President. Months ago, the Fed decided to bail out major investment banks. That put billions of taxpayer dollars at risk without so much as a single act of Congress. Lately, the Fed has been looking into the capital assets of those banks and telling them how to bolster their liquidity. Probably a good idea, but here again, nobody authorized the Fed to do this. Now the Fed is issuing proposed regulations governing the credit card industry. They specify when credit card issuers can increase interest rates on existing balances, and they bar late fees on customers who weren't given a reasonable amount of time to pay. Seems reasonable, but the Fed should also stop issuers from marketing credit cards to people under age 21 and imposing extra charges for paying online. But what I or you may want is irrelevant. The Fed's proposal drew nearly 56,000 comments, yet the Fed isn't compelled to read a single one of them. Again, the Fed is acting without any authorization by Congress. In fact, 2 weeks ago, a congressional committee reported out a credit cardholder's bill of rights. But the banking industry mounted such a lobbying effort against it, there's no way it will get enacted this year or maybe ever. Congress is so immobilized, we have to rely on the Fed, which operates mostly in secret, whose chair is appointed every 4 years, but whose other governors have 14-year terms, and which doesn't even depend on a congressional appropriation for its own funding. It's not Chinese authoritarian capitalism, but it's not exactly democracy either.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Let us hear from you when you get a minute. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, understanding the real value of loose change.
I mean, people see change as just nothing worthwhile or significant. My daughter, on the other hand, when she sees a penny, she says 99 more make a dollar.
Smart kid. But first, let's do the numbers. Not that anybody's counting, but that's three down days in a row for the Dow. The Dow Industrials dropped 0.9% today, 109 points to close at 11,532. The Nasdaq was pretty much flat, dropping 2 points, finished at 2428. The S&P 500 lost roughly 0.3%, about 3 points, to end the day at 1285. Investment banks suffered after Merrill Lynch analysts lowered the ratings in Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, and Morgan Stanley. Morgan Stanley was the biggest decliner, losing 5.5%. Crude oil rose to $116 a barrel. Not coincidentally, Delta and United Airlines both lost more than 9% today. Continental Airlines was off more than 11%. Warner Music Group shares were cut by 9%, the company's biggest loss in more than 2 months. Back home, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.94%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for the month of July. The Airline Pilots Association International concludes its two-day annual forum on air safety and security. And the cartoonist who offered a humorous glimpse into the unobserved life of animals and other creatures celebrates his birthday. The Far Side author Gary Larson turns 58. I'm Michelle Phillibee.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. NBC is still hauling in the ratings for the Olympics, even though we all know what the scores and standings are well before we turn on the TV in primetime. That, of course, is making the network and its advertisers very, very happy people. For companies that were actually planning to do some business during the games, though, it's a different story. Scott Tong is in Beijing this week covering the business behind the Olympics. Hi, Scott.
Hello, Kai. How are you?
I'm all right, thanks. But listen, give us the nickel tour. You're there at the center of the universe.
Well, the circus has come to the universe here, and it is on TV. You cannot escape a television here where there are five or six channels broadcasting the live feeds or the analysis. I mean, there are TVs in the hotel room lobbies, on the hotel elevators, and in restaurants. And just in case you missed it, every large public park has a humongous screen where you can follow everything here. But here's the question, where are all the people to watch all this? You know, this hotel, which should be crawling with people, is fairly empty. And of course, the logical reason is it's for all the security that they've put up here. The locals have been told don't drive your cars in town because of the pollution. The foreigners are having trouble getting their visas. So the upside of all of this is like they've cleared a little bit of this place out, like it's the Adult Swim.
At the neighborhood pool, yeah. Let me ask you this, though. The corporate sponsors of these games, and lots of other sponsors as well, paid millions and millions of dollars to get people interacting with their products. What do they have to say about it?
Well, in some cases, $200 million to be the top international sponsors. A PR person for one of these big sponsors said, you know, we put up these huge exhibit halls in different parts of Beijing, and we have our big glitzy one on the Olympic grounds, and we never plan for not enough people coming. Having said that, they do understand it. They have to live in China. They understand the political situation. They have to kind of roll with it. What the corporate sponsors can do is just to stay on message. And the message here is root, root, root for the home team. McDonald's is a giant sponsor, and their motto and their campaign here is, I'm loving it when China wins. Hmm. The broader point being these companies want to localize, feel like they're fitting in with the locals in China. They do have to be careful that they don't look like they're pandering to the local crowd, but basically, people seem to be smiling.
Mm. What about on the sidelines away from the games, Scott? What's going on there amongst the lifestyles of the rich and famous?
Well, you know the annual corporate schmoozing event known as Davos, where you've got Murdoch and Bill Gates, etc., who are kind of roaming and talking to other guys in suits. Well, there is a whole sideshow of that going on here as well. And I have to tell you what people are telling me since I don't get invited to these kind of things. I ran into a few Ethiopian journalists who told me that Beijing paid their entire airfare and their hotels to come to China and their tickets to the soccer game. You wonder what the government of China may be wanting to get out of this from some of the African countries where they're obviously investing a lot of money to get the natural resources. Of course, multinational companies also want to get things out of China to get permission to enter the China market, to set up factories. So Western multinational companies have a whole lot of corporate hospitality stuff going on as well. And some of that is about currying favor with the right people here. And once again, it's what we're hearing because folks like me don't get to see that.
Yeah, but you'll always have the memory. Scott Tong in Beijing at the Olympics for us. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Good to talk to you.
Pinching your pennies is a common enough phrase in tough economic times. Lots of people are probably doing that, metaphorically, anyway. But what about actually pinching those pennies as you find them lying on the ground? From the mean streets of New York City, Sally Herships reports.
How much loose change do you think you've passed on the street? A few cents? A penny here, a penny there? And who stops for a penny anyway? The Humphrey family does.
Hi!
Barbara and Scott Humphrey live with their two daughters in New York City. They've been collecting loose change from the street for a few years now.
This is it. This is our fiscal year 2008 change pot jar.
And even they're surprised by how much they've found.
What is your grand total so far?
I know.
Daughter number one, Brianna.
It's $1,013 and something cents. I can't remember the change.
Just to be clear, this is money they've found on the ground. It's sort of a hobby. They take a lot of long walks.
We're all looking around. You know, we have our glasses, we have our Purell bottles, we have our little change purses.
The family has a blog called Change Pot, where Barbara keeps a running tally of their findings.
Because I figured it would be a nice way at the end of the day, kind of like a Doogie Howser thing. You know how at the end of the day he'd write down things? We basically keep track of it that way.
It all started about 3 years ago when Barbara was at college and saw some money on the ground.
In my school, people, they complain about not having any money. But meanwhile, there's 7 cents on the floor. Nobody would pick it up.
So she did. But there were some odd looks, even from Scott.
I thought she needed help because I'm like, why are you picking up change? I mean, I make a decent salary. What is this? And 3 years later, it's added up kind of nice.
And now the whole family contributes.
Even you can find a broken penny in the street.
Even six-year-old Karen knows to look for beaten-up coins. Banks will give you clean, new, shiny ones in exchange. But not all change seekers are in the Humphreys League.
Currently, as of right now, I have found $268.11. But I did find a dime and two pennies on the way over here.
Scott Caulfield lives in St. Louis. He also chronicles his finds on a blog called Change Race, and he seems to share a certain outlook on life with the Humphreys.
I'm the kind of guy I'd much rather drive around for 5 or 10 minutes and find a free spot or a metered spot than pay $7 or $8. It's kind of just a different way of thinking. I don't look at it as cheap. I just look at it as smart.
He's a totally dedicated change hunter, even on the most important day of his life.
I found one penny on the dance floor during my wedding.
Scott sees the value in small change.
It's interesting how people just walk away. You know, they'll drop a quarter, they'll drop a nickel, they'll drop a dime, and they'll walk away.
I mean, people see change as just nothing worthwhile or significant. My daughter, on the other hand, when she sees a penny, she says 99 more make a dollar. And I'm very proud of her for that. Very proud.
Neither the Humphreys or Scott Caulfield have specific plans for their savings. But I know what I'm going to do. Follow some advice I got from Scott. Keep my head down and look for silver. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
We've got links to the blogs that Sally mentioned, as well as her own try looking for spare change, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, perhaps, maybe, hopefully, the last word there will be on the Yahoo-Microsoft deal that never was. The company says in a regulatory filing that it spent $36 million fighting back Steve Ballmer's unsolicited takeover bid and Carl Icahn's efforts to force a proxy fight. Lawyers got a good chunk of the money, of course. So did Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers. The Associated Press did the math for us. Based on Yahoo's earnings for the first half of the year, that $36 million is about 5% of the company's profit during that time. Yahoo shares closed today about $20. That's down from about $27 the day that offer was made. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 109 points, 0.9%. The Nasdaq dipped 2 points, basically flat. The S&P 500 lost 3 points, 0.3%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, sex and fear in a European boomtown.
I hate, but I have no enough money, that's why I must do it.
It's another installment of our series, Working. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.